just having me speak on Muhammad, if I don't do it a certain way, I would fall under the blasphemy laws of the Sharia. If a Muslim thinks that I am disrespectful to Muhammad, I'm under a death penalty. That's no kidding. That's the way it is. If you go over to England, you will find the signs. Behead him. Anything that brings offense to Islam or to Muslims, there's a death penalty. And it's a real one. Sirah Rasul Allah. That is the written documentation or written life of the Apostle Muhammad. That's how they say it when they open the book. Muhammad, you have to go way back. Go back to the 16th chapter of the book of Genesis. When Hagar ran from her mistress and was in the desert, the Lord said this to her. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. I haven't got it on, so I got to turn this thing on, I guess.
Is it not on?
I don't get a red light. I'm probably doing the wrong thing.
Push that top button on.
The top button?
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
You hear it?
Operator error. Anyway, let's go back again to Genesis, the 16th chapter, and verse 11. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And then over in Genesis, the 21st chapter, again, this time she has been cast out by Abraham. And over in the 18th verse, it says, Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thy hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went, and filled the bottle with water, and gave the lad drink. And God said, or God was with the lad, and he grew, and dwelt in the wilderness, and became an archer. So that's what happened to Ishmael. But Ishmael is claimed the fatherhood of all the Arabs. So from Ishmael came the Arabs. Have you ever noticed that Ishmael, and where he located was in southern Arabia, but if you notice, remember Esau? Where did Esau go? Esau went just above that in Saudi Arabia. And it's interesting about following the history of those two men. But anyway, Ishmael, they claim, is the one who founded the family of the Arabs. But look what it also says here. I will make him a great nation. And this is what it was. That well, in the last one, they claim that well is located in the Kaaba. or that square building that you see in Mecca. But in that, there's a square building, and then there's the, if you want to call it the mosque, all the way around it, that open area. And there is that well there, and that well is what they say is where Ishmael got the water, Hagar got the water, and they call that well Zamzam. Interesting. So that's a precious well to them because it's historical to them. Now, if you take a look at the time of Muhammad, pre-Islam, if you want to say that, it was the nomadic tribes that lived in the area. And they lived by raising camels, everything that they could, they'd breed camels, everything of a camel they would use for something. Camels, goats, and they would raise sheep. Those were the main things that was there. Horses came a little later, but the main products, again, was camel because they used it for transportation and all that. If you take a look at the land, there's 120,000 square miles of desert. That's a little bit of land. That's desert. Arid areas with a few, what you call oases, where there were springs. And around these springs, usually, they would build a temple, or not a temple, but they would build a town around the oasis. Every tribe and clan basically had their own gods. And usually there was some form of a rock. Rocks with shapes, rocks without shapes. Small rocks, big rocks. They had those. They worshipped the moon. They worshipped the sun. They believed that the moon and the sun got together, and that's where you get the stars. So these are the type of things that were going on. They had a lot of fetishes during that time. So anyway, you're taking a look at that kind of thing. That great Nafud Desert. How many remember or saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia? When he said that they crossed the great Nafud. They went all the way from Egypt to where? Across the great Nafud Desert. And then at Aqaba there, if you take a look, if you got your Bible, you might find one of the maps in there that shows you where Aqaba is. It's called Eilat. And today that's one of the great harbors that is there. So the main way of transportation was camels. Then also that they followed the what you call riverbeds, the wadis. So that's where they would use for traveling. Now, in driving, going to down to Petra, I went through what was called the Wadi Musa, the Wadi of Moses. And the driver was saying this is probably where Moses camped out for a while with his people, there in the Wadi Musa. But it also contains what is called the King's Highway. It's a highway or a camel trail that went from Egypt all the way down to Aqaba. And then from Aqaba, it would go north to Syria, or it would divide off and go to Jerusalem the other way, or it would go another way and go off to Iraq. So that was the main camel trails. The difference is today, they're paved. We went down there. We went the road that probably Moses was on. We went to the road that maybe, if talking about Petra, that probably where Paul went when he went south into Saudi Arabia. So here's the kind of picture that you have. People are Bedouins. They live by those kind of raising animals, but also they live by raiding each other. But they didn't raid each other to kill each other. It was kind of like a game to them. They would raid to get some goats or sheep, or if they did want to have a fight, they usually sent out their one man. Remember David and Goliath, where they sent out the one man to represent them? That's how they operated in those days. So anyway, that they didn't want to kill anybody, because if you did that, then you had a blood feud. Then you have a big problem when tribe would kill off tribes. So anyway, that they wouldn't do that. Some of the mountains are over 10,000 feet high. So anyway, that's the type of land that was there, and a type of people that was basically there. Now again, their religion was basically studying rocks. They had supreme god, which was called Hubble, and that's the one that was in the Kaaba, in that mosque there, was 360 gods. So we go on a little further, and we find out the sub-gods that were there were El Uzza and Alat. Those were the main sub-gods that were worshipped there. Now, there's basically two tribes of people. One who live in the desert, and the other who lived in the cities. The city dwellers made their money by trade, by silversmiths, craftsmen, financiers, mainly in Mecca. Every year, twice a year, they would send out a trading caravan. Can you imagine over 4,000 camels in a caravan? How far would that, how long would that be? 4,000. They would go north to Syria, and in the winter they would probably go south to Yemen. But these were big caravans that went on. So now what happens? In Mecca, in the year 570, Muhammad was born. His mother, Amina, lived up with the tribes for a while. The husband of Muhammad died while she was pregnant. And she died, and Muhammad ended up going to his grandfather. And his grandfather, not very long after that, he's about 6 or 9 years old, he died, and he gets shipped off to his uncle in Mecca. Now, the uncle, Al-Talib, is, if you want to say, a big shot. He's very big in the tribe. And he basically is in charge of the Kaaba and the feeding of all the pilgrims that come through there. He also is involved in camel caravans and trade. And when Muhammad was very young, probably about 12, they said, that he went on the caravans for his uncle, or with his uncle. So what happens from that? Because of what he did, and made money at it, he got a name of being very trustworthy. And there was a lady named Khadija. She was a widow lady. And her husband had died, and she was very, if you want to say it, wealthy. She was a wealthy woman. Asked for him to come and to run her caravan for her. So he did that. And when he returned, he had done so well that she offered Abu Talib, "I'd like to marry this young guy." And she's 40 years old, and he's 25. So anyway, they get married. And they're married for 25 years. So at that time, he was only had one wife for the first 25 years. And then she died. And he got another wife. But in the meantime, what normally he did on Ramadan, Ramadan is a sacred month with them where they, back where we were, they give gifts to their friends, and it's basically a religious month. He would go off to a cave called Hira, not very far out of Mecca, and he would kind of take a religious retreat. So while he was on one of these retreats, he said that the angel Gabriel came to him and told him to be a reciter. He says, "How can I recite?" And again, he said, "You're going to be a reciter. You're going to be a warner of the people." So he ran home to Khadija. He's all shook up by having this vision or whatever it is. Some say that he was an epileptic. But some say he was just a typical soothsayer that tribes had at that time. But anyway, he started warning, he didn't start warning the people, he kept this thing private. And he only told the people around him, told them that they needed to have one God and no other gods. That they needed to treat people fairly and not to be abuser financially with these people that they're dealing with. So after 3 years, he had collected a few people, not many. And then he started to openly preach. So when he started preaching, there was a problem. The people in Mecca made their money by taking care of all these pilgrims that came in once, mainly during a year, but also during other times of years they'd come, but just one special time on Ramadan. And they would buy their idols, get fed, and Muhammad was interfering with the idol business. Interfering because all these different tribes had their gods in this Kaaba. So he is messing with their financial. So the people even came to a point where they called him in and said, look, we'll make you a king. We'll make you rich. All you have to do is to give up this monotheism that you believe in. But he refused to do it. So what they did is they boycotted him for 3 years, him and his followers. They wouldn't trade with him, wouldn't talk with him, wouldn't do anything with him. But he wouldn't give up those things. And then they started persecuting him, him and his followers. They would beat him. They wanted to kill him. Some of them took off and went to, if you want to call it, Ethiopia, and stayed there because there was a Christian king there who at least wasn't persecuting them. So they went off for a number of years there. And when they came back, it even got worse because when Khadija, his wife, died, the same year his uncle Abu Talib died. But Abu Talib, remember, he is the man that is in charge of, or the, if you want to say it, he is the leader of the tribe of Hashim. And when he died, Muhammad lost his protection. The only thing that was saving him from being killed was being under the protection of Talib. And that's the way it is. If you go into an Islamic country and you're not under the protection of someone, you're free game. But if somebody says you're under my protection and my hospitality, then the other folks cannot mess with him. So now he has no protection. So he goes south to another village to see if he can get protection there, and they'd run him out, wouldn't have anything to do with him. But while this is going on, this is for 10 years this was going on, a group that came from Medina, it was called Yathrib at that time, down and met him at Aqaba and said, come, we want to talk to you. It's a secret meeting. So he went down and talked to them. And they said, move, come on, come up to Medina where we are. Come up there and you'll be protected and we have great plans for you since you're a prophet. So they had two meetings like that. And finally, he agreed. So what happens was that they start migrating up to Medina. But the Meccans started finding out these people are disappearing where they're going. Because the one thing they don't want is they don't want the propagation of this message of one God to interfere with their business again. So they offered 100 camels to anyone, because he snuck out of town, that could find him so they could kill him. But he got to Mecca, or to Medina. When he got to Medina, they wanted him so good, or so much, that they made a thing called the Constitution of Medina. Actually, that gave him power over all the tribes, both Jewish, pagan, if you want to look at that, and Islamic, that were there. So he had the power to be the run the justice department, if you want to put it that way, between the tribes. And that power he used to promote his own people. In the marketplace there was operated by Jews mostly, and they were silversmiths and goldsmiths. And you have to look at the people that decided to leave and go up to Medina were city dwellers. Now they're no longer in their own environment. Now they're in a bunch of farmers. And none of these folks know about farming. So they have no income coming in. And more people keep flocking to Muhammad. And they're operating off the charity of people, but charity only goes so long before these people got tired of putting out their resources on these people who are not doing anything. So what happens there? Muhammad decides it's time to take retribution against those in Mecca that had persecuted him. So that they go back to the old way, the old Arab way, the old tribal way of raiding. Raiding and booty. So they would go and raid the different caravans, but especially the ones of his own tribe in retaliation. So when that happened, of course the Meccans, now that they're starting to get raided, decide they got to put a stop to this. We can't afford to let these things keep going on. So they knew that they were sending a caravan out. And also they sent out an army with them. And they met at a place called Badr. It's called the Battle of Badr. The battle started where the Muslims were way outnumbered. But because of telling them, Muhammad kept telling them, hey, if you die in battle, you immediately go to paradise. So they were very valiant, if you want to put it that way. And they whooped the Meccans, sent them home packing. But because of that situation, Muhammad took advantage of that to write some surahs saying, yes, if you die, God gave the victory to you because you're Muslims. He gave it to you because you're doing God's will. And guess what? There's also booty involved if you take over a caravan. So there was money. Then some of the local tribes decided, hey, you know, we don't want to be a target. So maybe it's best that we convert. We'll convert and add ourselves to the, convert to Islam. And now we are part of the ones that are going to go out and raid and get the booty. So tribes started coming to him that way. And he kept getting more people. Now the difference in other religions between Islam, how can I say this? Islam looked at all tribes, all clans, being one community. Didn't matter what tribe you were from. If you were a Muslim, you were in the community. And that's how they speak today. The community. All one. One for all, if you want to put it that way. And so, no matter who you are, what country you're in. If you become a Muslim, you're part of that community. So it started growing that way. So as they grew, remember, the Meccans are still in a situation where they still got to get their caravans going to Syria and all that. So again, they went to battle. It's called the Battle of Uhud. Now, they were pretty well matched at the battle. But there was a problem. Remember, you're there for what? Booty, if you're going to raid a caravan. What happened is Muhammad got into the battle with his troops, but all his archers saw the other men falling, and what did they do? They deserted their post to go get the booty. And somebody yelled that Muhammad had been killed. So they turned around and took off. If the Meccans had pursued them, there would have been no Islam today if they'd only pursued them. But they didn't do it. So there's one final battle that they get in. But during this time, you got to remember, I said that the Jews had date farms, they had silversmiths and all these things. And guess what? He's the arbitrator, and his word is law. So when there became a situation between a Jew and a Muslim, guess who got the winning side? And he ended up running out a number of these tribes and taking over their date farms, taking over their property. And of course, there was one tribe there that didn't like this at all. And what they did is the next time the Meccans decide that they're going to go to battle, we're going to join you against Muhammad and his folks. And this is called the Battle of the Trench, or the Battle of the Clans. Because other clans outside of just the Jews and the Meccans, again, that didn't join in with Muhammad, went against him. Now, it's called the Battle of the Trench because a Syrian fella advised Muhammad to build a trench around Mecca, or Medina. So they built the trench. And with the weapons of war that they had at the time, when Mecca came against them, they couldn't win. So they left, went home. But Muhammad found out that the Jews that were left had conspired against him. So what he did was he attacked them, took between 700 and 900 men that he'd captured from the tribe, took them down to the market, dug a trench, and beheaded all the men, 700 to 900. Sold the Jewish women, took them as concubines, or sold them as slaves, took the children, sold them as slaves. Now, if Mecca can't conquer him, he is the ruler of the area. That solidified him. Now he is a warlord. And all during this time, there's little bits of Syria come along. When Khadijah died in 619, he married a woman named Swada, but also a fellow named Abu Bakr, who becomes the first caliph after Muhammad dies, gives to Muhammad his 6-year-old daughter. When Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina, the first day that they're back, he consumes that marriage, consummates that marriage with Aisha, and she's 9 years old. Brought her in from her dolls. In the end, Muhammad had 11 wives living at the time that he died. No telling how many concubines or slaves that he owned, but he would sell them off or he would use them for his sexual pleasures during that time. Muhammad becomes again a warlord. So now that he has gone up to another Jewish town called Kabar, a lot of the Jews who left the first time went to Kabar, which is up kind of northeast of Medina. So they had wonderful farms up there, date farms and things. So Muhammad went up there with his army and took over Kabar. Now there was a Jewish woman there and invited Muhammad to dinner. And Muhammad went with a couple of his men. She poisoned him, but he didn't get enough to kill him. So after that, he forgave her. He takes up his army, and now he's at the strength where he can go back to Mecca and take Mecca. And that's what he does. He goes back with his army, basically without a bloodless battle. He takes Mecca, goes in, destroys all the 360 idols, and tells the people of the town that every house needed to get rid of its idol. If it didn't get rid of its idol, then you're going to get killed. So that's what they do. There's still a couple of battles to go on. But basically, that's what happens. Now, Muhammad, not long after that, has a couple of more battles. But then he finally succumbs to that poison that Jewish woman had given him. And when he died, remember, all these tribes that had joined him voluntarily or involuntarily had to pay a tax. So he collected this tax from all the tribes. But guess what? Muhammad's dead. He's no longer alive. And guess what? We're not going to pay the tax anymore. So it goes into what's called the war of apostasy. And Abu Bakr, who becomes the first caliph, beats them and restores them under the Islamic cover, if you want to put it that way. When that happens, he is now the ruler of Saudi Arabia, all the way to Syria, all the way over to Iraq. You'll find out in the next next lecture, I hope, that you'll find that his expansion under three caliphs goes from India to Northern Europe to Spain. And you will find the finalization of the Quran during the reign of Uthman. The Quran was developed. All those collected from papers were collected from all over, put together. And Altman says, well, this is the one I want. This is what I don't want. So there goes the inspiration of the Quran. I look at it. And that's how it goes. Now, I don't know what else to tell you today. Hopefully that the next time I talk, we'll talk about the caliphate and these four men, four successors, and what is called the Shia Sunni split, which is the war that is still going on today. And it's a war to the death. Islam is looking at who's going to rule the world. Is it going to be the Sunnis or is it going to be the Shiites? And that is the big war that's going on internally now. That's what I have for you today. Is there any question that I might be able to answer for you now?
Back in the 1980s, Iraq and Iran, they had a big war, about a 500,000 deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of those that you just talked about, one of them is one religion, the other deaths?
Iraq, how can I say it? Iraq is mostly Sunni. But the holy places of Iran are in Iraq. So that's part of it. Now I can give you a better answer when I study it out. But that's what I look at, is that's that still ongoing thing. The Sunnis in Pakistan said that they're going to kill every Shiite that they can get a hold of. Is there... Look at a couple of things. One, he claims to be a prophet. Prophets were the things of Old Testament, correct? Who's up there in the north? In Medina. Jews are up there. So, he's trying to put himself to the Jews, guess what? I'm the prophet. That's one of the reasons they invited him up there. Because they thought the Jews up there thought he was the coming Messiah that had been prophesied. That he was it. But then, when they started, after he got up there, started seeing what he was doing, what he's saying, what he's teaching, they said, there's no way. Apostle. What do we have in the New Testament? Apostles. So he is applying himself to the Christians as an apostle.
How did he get to the Dome of the Rock, the last place he went up there?
The Dome of the Rock.
Yeah, how did he get to
the dream. A dream. He never went there. It was a dream.
It's just a dream.
That he had gone to the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem and had visited the seven heavens and met Moses, met John the Baptist, met Jesus, met all these different people. And if you go to the Dome of Rock today, that dream is etched around the inside of the dome that's there. Is that dream that him going up to the seven heavens? Talk to Gabriel up there. Another question?
Okay. When did you build the dome there? What year was that?
Ooh, you hit me for a date. It was during the caliphate of Omar. So it wasn't long. He was the second caliph after Muhammad. So you're looking within 100 years, I believe, or less. Any other question? If you have some, let me ask you to write them down, because we hope to collect some of these questions and work them out and maybe publish it. So, if we can, that I've already started something, which is called A Few Questions and Answers about Islam.
When did they start going to North Africa, like Egypt and all that, right away?
Assyria? Not long. You're talking about Omar again.
Okay.
So Omar was the big one that started the, if you call it, the Zimmi program. Found out you can't just capture and kill everybody. You've got to have farmers. You've got to have all these people to pay the tax.
Could you just, in a few moments, relate to us about a man who has been converted, who was a professor in Cairo, and questioned the difference of the two versions of the Quran?
Mustafa. He's written a number of books, and his name is Mark Gabriel under his name he uses now. But he was a history teacher in the University of Cairo, the most prestigious of all the universities. That's where they look to today for all the doctrines that come out, is to Al-Azhar University. That's the place for Islam. He took a sabbatical, went to Iran, saw a different Quran, different version. There's a problem here. How many versions can there be? One. So when he went back, he asked one of the other professors, what is this? 2 o'clock in the morning, the secret police bust down his door, haul him off to prison and torture him for asking the question. Now, he was, can you imagine? He didn't say anything against it. He just wanted to know. That's it. So, again, he ended up being tortured. His family somehow was able to get him out. So now he has no job. He is ostracized. He is depressed. So he goes to a pharmacist. The pharmacist is a Christian. He gets a Bible. Starts reading the Sermon on the Mount. Compares that to Muhammad in Islam, to Jesus in the Scriptures. So he is converted. He goes to South Africa and he returns. And I guess he was like some of those, he wants to wear something Christian, so he's wearing a Christian cross. His father sees it. He admits that he is converted. His father goes and gets a gun and tries to kill him. So he escapes to his sister's house. The father notifies the secret police. While walking to his sister's house one evening, he is accosted and stabbed a number of times before he escapes and ends up here in the United States. His books are on the list there, called Mark Gabriel. that's reality, folks. Reality, if I say anything against Muhammad, I'm eligible for the death penalty.
They have a secret police that Islam, like the Russia?
Well, he had the Taliban. Egypt has its secret police. What will happen is if Islam gets into this country, remember the Taliban, and it's the same way in Saudi Arabia. If this group of enforcers walks down the street and sees that you have violated Islamic law in some ways, they'll beat you right there publicly. In India, the town religious man was of the town that he was in saw a lady holding hands with somebody that wasn't of their tribe and sent his men to rape her. 18 men to rape her. And that was her punishment for holding hands with somebody that wasn't of their tribe. Hey, that's what they're pushing for. Anything else? How they view life? Life is the right path. Life is Sharia law. That is life to them. Death, if you are killing infidel, that's immediate going to paradise. That's why you see all these folks blowing themselves up, because immediately they get to go to paradise.
How many virgins?
Supposedly 72.
Where'd they get that number?
That's their number. That's the number in the head.
I'm 72.
So, ladies, doesn't say what women get up there. They say there's very little chance of a woman going to paradise. Two things that are problems: the camel and the women. That's how they look at it. The level. You're a piece of property. Anything else?
Always in time.
Okay.
There's probably time to close and give you some rest, but what a contrast with the gospel.
Yeah.
I've talked to some Muslims here in business situations. Our church is the only one to talk with Muslims when they came into this community to have a dialogue with the Christians. That was an interesting meeting. But speak to them in the right way. There is hope in the gospel. God opens Muslims. In Africa, they are very concerned about Muslims converting to Christianity. That's a wonderful thing.
And that's why they got the mosque here. The mosque is a control factor. To control. Because when people come into the Muslim community, migrate here or immigrate here, who are they going to tie in with? They're going to tie in with the Muslim community that they live in.
So and this will become Saudi California.
Wouldn't that be a shame?
No.
But that's where the control factor is, in the mosque. We'll deal with that. It's part of the three facets of taking control. Next week, go ahead.
I don't know if you can answer this, but virtually in every town, the hamlet in Europe, the center of town is a Catholic church. So everything is from everything focused on the church. They rang the bell, people came, whatever it was, the church was in control. Did the Catholic church get that idea from the Muslims, or the Muslims take it from the Catholics?
Well, I would say that if you're dealing with Babylonian history, you will find a lot of that comes from Babylonian history. The hierarchy of priest. The hierarchy of priest in the Catholic Church.
I appreciate the question. Tell us what building has to dominate, and I'm giving it away. The mosque must be higher than the steeple of the Catholic Church. Wherever it is, the church must be under the shadow of the minaret of the mosque.
And that's their goal. A lot. If you are a rich man, a rich Muslim, it's your responsibility to make sure that there is a mosque in your neighborhood, and you are responsible to make sure that that comes. We'll deal with that for you next week. Next time, we'll deal with the caliphate and the Shia split, because they go like this. So we'll see what's going on in the world today. How many have ever heard of the Shias before? Yeah, just a few. How many have ever heard of Sunnis? That's the major thing around here. So maybe we'll deal with a little Sufism.
But
yeah, they're the mystics. They're the ones that believe in you can talk. How should I say that? Sharia law is the outward manifestation of God. Sufism is the inner manifestation of God. That's how they look at it. So they're looking at love. They're looking at Gnosticism and that.
I just want to say thank you, because I know that Pastor Dana gave you this project probably 2 years ago, maybe more. And so to delve into a subject like this and give your basically your life to it over the last few years must be extremely depressing. And so you're giving us all this information at a great cost to you. So I really appreciate what you've done.
Well, thank you. It's been very enlightening to me. It sure gives me an outlook about the world that is totally different than what it was 2 years ago, 2.5. So, I appreciate it.
I'm not sure you do. Don't worry. Gone long today.
Okay.
Brother Mellon was an Amman Jordan working for the State Department for quite some time. And played chess with the King of Jordan, by the way. And has a great respect for those people. Syria today, tomorrow Jordan. They want to take over all those countries. They go in, it's simple like communism. Start unrest. Our State Department is absolutely stupid. President Bashar, protect the Christians in Syria. Now they're going to have a radical Muslim government there, going to kill all the Christians. And we don't have any, well, unless our Muslim president really understands what's going on. Our country is so stupid. We haven't learned a thing. We don't have that religious mentality that would put things together. Christians do. Muslims do not. Done very well to them. We covered much of just the groundwork to see what's going on. And the next time, as you said, we'll deal with the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Sufis, and that's the infighting today. The Sufis have an influence here. You wouldn't think so. Haven't you heard people say the real jihad is a matter of the heart? They're trying to Americanize an inward spiritual battle. If I want to improve my health, it's my jihad and so forth. It's just infiltrating our culture.
They're the ones that are winning.
Yes.
More American converts than Sunni or Shia.
It sort of fits in with a New Age modern mentality. Well, let us pray.